Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo, and this afternoon we are going to be having a conversation with a lady who was married to a legend. I said was married because he passed away about 5 years ago, if I understand correctly, and that is Bob Denver. Who is Bob Denver? Well, if you're real young, maybe you won't remember the name Bob Denver, but I'll bet you you'll remember Gilligan. Yes. That wonderful, zany character that so many people fell in love with and is still memorable today on a show called Gilligan's Island. I want to welcome his lovely wife, Dreema Denver, to the show today. Dreema, so glad you're able to join me.
I am so happy to be with you today. Thank you for having me.
I have to ask you, Dreema, in putting this book together, were you and Bob, were you working on this together? Did he decide that he was that this was something that was his job and he was going to tell his story? What inspired him to write the book, Gilligan, Maynard, and Me?
You know, that was back in 1993, and he actually was approached to write a book. It was the 40th, if I remember correctly, it was the 40th anniversary of Gilligan's Island, and he was approached to write a book and decided that he would write a book that was career-driven. It's more about, for fans of Gilligan's Island, it's more about, you know, what happened behind the scenes and how they did. It's more of that than it is like a personal biography about marriages and divorces and all that. It's really a career book that that he decided to write. And I watched him do it, Donna. He wrote every single word of that book. There was no ghostwriter or collaborator or anything. He did it all himself.
This show came about at a very interesting time because it's one of those shows that to me has so many funny human aspects to it, all of the characters that were in there. And of course, he's this slapstick type of personality, whimsical. He just seems gawky. He's got this naiveness that I made up my own word there, that I just think is absolutely incredible. And people of any age enjoyed it. And when I think of so much of what's on television today, I go, how did we ever get from just good entertainment, and I guess I'm being biased here with that attitude, but from good entertainment to all this chop, hack, dash, and so-called reality stuff that often, Jimmy, is literally boring because it isn't, to me, entertaining. That's my bias.
And it's not reality either.
No, it isn't.
I know people, you know, when reality shows first started, Survivor is the one I'm thinking of. Bob was interviewed about that show and got in some trouble here in West Virginia locally, with not in trouble, but I mean, there were people who took exception to the fact that he said, you know, reality TV isn't reality, but it really isn't. I mean, there's nothing real about even Survivor, where you're out there with a camera crew of 60 people, and you know how all that works, you know. So, you know, when Bob was creating the character of Gilligan, the thing that he did and the thing that I think makes it appeal to audiences of all ages and certainly gives it longevity is he wanted it, number one, to appeal to 2 to 90. You know, he wanted all ages to enjoy the show. And when he was creating Gilligan's Island, his son Patrick was, I think, maybe 5 years old at that time. And so what he did with that character was watch his son every day, to watch the wonderment, you know, the newness of everything to a kid kind of finding things out for the first time. And that's what he wanted to bring to the character of Gilligan. He wanted that naivete and that wonderment at the world and the curiosity about things. And he also, his big thing he told me was that he wanted kids to see that they could screw up, and they could screw up royally, and mom and dad could get mad, or brother and sister could get mad at them, but in the end, it was always going to be okay because you were loved. And that's kind of the way it was with Gilligan, you know?
Absolutely. All of the characters were really so individual in their in their drama, and yet for all of this wackiness, including Mr. Jim Backus, who I will always remember as Mr. Magoo. I don't think anybody could have ever done that character as well as he did, and he played his obnoxious, elitist, rich role to the hilt. I mean,
he
just did it so well. He just was absolutely wonderful. And his so-called ditzy wife, who was anything but that. But I just,
right.
You know, you have all these wonderful, wonderful characters. And I think what it did, people could go through this imaginary role of whichever character they were drawn to in Gilligan's Island and really find, it just was a relief. Because life at best is a pretty tough proposition. And to be able to enjoy, be entertained, watch people flop, watch Gilligan do some of the worst things you could ever imagine, and you just go and go, oh my, what was your head? And it just, it sort of allowed you to be okay with where you were for that time that when you were watching the show. So it was great. But let's go into some of his background.
Mm-hmm.
Because he really got bitten by the acting bug, and it seemed like it munched on him for his entire life. Am I right?
I think it did. You know, he was actually kind of by accident got into acting the first go-round at Loyola in Los Angeles. He was in college, and as I remember, there was, you know, a part, Falstaff, actually, needed to be cast, and, you know, he's not somebody you would think of for that part, but he went ahead and auditioned and got the part because they thought he was, you know, very funny and kind of a comedy relief, and, you know, said that when he went on stage the first time, his knees were literally knocking, and he was funny because he was so scared, but it came across mm-hmm. as comedy, you know. And so he was bitten by the bug in that moment and never quite got rid of it after that. You know, he stumbled again into the part of Maynard G. Krebs on Dobie Gillis, the first series that he did. Kind of stumbled into that. His sister worked at 20th Century Fox, and she told him they were auditioning for this part, and she kind of sneaked his name on the list and got him in, and he won that part over like 500 other young actors who at the time were auditioning with Dwayne Hickman, and he won it mm-hmm. because he and Dwayne had really excellent chemistry together, you know, and played off each other well and all of that. So that was kind of the beginning of the TV, you know, the whole TV career. And
well,
he was the breakout character from that show. You know, he was kind of the mm-hmm. Fonzie of that era of television, you know?
Mm-hmm, he was. But I have a photo of him in the Dobie Gillis, you know, Dwayne Hickman. And I
mm-hmm.
look at your husband, and he looks like this real mental dork that is spaced out into La La Land somewhere. And here is this handsome Dobie Gillis portrayal, you know, with the sparkling eyes, and he's got the Ivy League look, and his hair is combed, and your husband's got on this dirty sweatshirt. He would have been described, I think, at the time as a beatnik style.
He was the first beatnik on television. They accused him over the years, actually, of starting the hippie movement in this country, which I don't think he actually did, but I guess he would take credit. He really loved, you know, doing that character because Maynard was so so kind of out there, you know, with listening to the mm-hmm. crocuses grow and listening to jazz, and he really enjoyed that character, and he loved that part in that show because it was word comedy. It was written by Max Schulman, who at the time was a really prolific Hollywood writer and a highly regarded writer, and he wrote a series of books, I think, called The Many Loves of Dobie Gillis, and then they turned it into a television series. The books didn't even include the character of Maynard, actually, and
mm-hmm.
they turned it into a television series, and, you know, he wrote really wonderful words for the cast to say, so Bob loved that part of Dobie Gillis. However, you know, when he was the breakout star of the show and was offered, you know, parts in series after Dobie Gillis, he chose Gilligan's Island because it was just the opposite. It was physical comedy, which he also
mm-hmm.
loved. So
mm-hmm.
he felt that he got the best of both worlds, you know, in his two most famous roles. He really got to do, in an excellent way, the things that he liked the best when it came to acting. You know, the best of both worlds, really.
I've got, again, another photo in front of me of him holding this flop-eared bunny. Oh, my goodness, I just looked at that. I loved the bunny. And he said, one of the cardinal rules in acting is beware of acting with children or with animals. But he totally ignored that because he blended. I mean, it was
he did,
amazing.
And he worked with animals a lot. I mean, he was almost attacked by a lion in Gilligan's Island one time. I don't know if you remember the episode where there's a lion loose on the island and it gets into the Howl's hut, and Gilligan doesn't realize it and runs in the hut and starts running back and forth on the set, you know, pushing things up against the door to keep the lion out while the lion is actually on the bed behind him. And that lion, all that Bob could think of was that he looked like a little mouse to that lion running back and forth, you know, dragging things. And that lion took a leap, and the trainer actually tackled him. And had he not tackled the lion, he would have, you know, been all over Bob. So he said that was pretty terrifying. He said you know, whatever it is from the very beginning of time that makes the hair stand up on the back of your neck, that happened to him.
Yes, yes.
When you hear that roar, you know from somewhere way back there what's coming, you know?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. And that's true. But he really, and I'm going to be going back a little bit to Dobie and the people that he played with when he was in the Dobie Gillis programming. I mean, these are people that in show business, really big. Warren Beatty, Weld, Florida Freebus, and you just have all of these. Frank Phelan, and the story that you have in here about Frank, about him dressing as a real Scotsman and then doing a flip on stage. And of course, the real Scotsman in the old days didn't have underwear, and when he did that cartwheel, Mother Nature blessed everyone with what she had offered Frank. And, you know, you have these stories in this book, and it's just right. And lots of times I think that is part of the magic.
I think it is, too, you know. And he was really lucky as a young actor to work with people of that caliber, truly. You know, Tuesday Weld at that time was only about 16 years old. I mean, she was on the
gorgeous.
Set. And she was beautiful, wasn't she?
No, she was gorgeous.
Oh, and she was on the set every day with her mom, you know, and Warren Beatty, you know, he doesn't claim Dobie Gillis. I don't think that's in his bio anywhere. Bob used to laugh about it because I think Warren was with the show the first year, you know, and they all knew. Bob said they took one look at him and went, well, he's not going to be here long. You know, he's way too handsome and he's way too everything. He's going to go on to bigger and better things. So, obviously, we all know that he did, and I don't think he really acknowledges Dobie Gillis all that much.
He brings out so many of the various things within show business. When we see a film, when we're watching television programs, unless they're done in front of a live audience, you have the special effects they're always working with, and I just love the section where it was titled, Too Many Cooks Spoil the Broth. I loved this. I just thought, this is typical. Tell us about that story and what happened.
Now, okay, I don't know if I'm sure about the story on this one. Now, tell me again.
Okay, this is when the director for this particular episode.
And we're talking about Dobie Gillis
the film
here?
Director, a film editor. And he had never directed anything before at all. And whenever you're on sets, you have specialists do certain things.
Right.
And this was an explosion where pots were to blow up. And you describe it in the book about everything that had to be set up. And he wanted it to be directed by word, 1, 2, 3, explosion, 3 vegetables were to pop. I mean, he was a numbers guy. Everything had to be done with the numbers.
Right.
He didn't know what he was doing. Not at all. And as I know when I'm reading this, it says the vegetables, the explosion, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, and everybody said, oh, God. They did it exactly the way he wanted it done. All the lids on the pots went up, the explosion went off, the vegetables came down, the lids came down and went back up, and more vegetables came down, and more things are going up and down. And I just read that, and I could just see that visual. And
I could see
everybody just saying, okay, you wouldn't let the people that know how to do it do it, so we followed your directions, and this is what you got.
That's right. Don't you find that when you read Bob's book that it it really is like, the thing I love about his book the most is it's, because I was privy to a lot of his, you know, storytelling firsthand. When you read the book, it really is like hearing him tell the story. I mean, I think mm-hmm. he, you know, his descriptive passages and all that are exactly the way, if you were sitting in the living room with him, having him tell you about that special effect, that's exactly the way he would have told it. And I always loved that about his book, because he, you know, it was directly from him. It was his words and his memories of it all. And that, you know, I kind of remember, that's not a story he told very much in actuality that's in the book. I remember the story, but not as clearly as, I'm happy that you told it to me, because now I'm remembering it much better. But that was, it was always funny to him to bring, you know, when new directors would come in and when special effects were, you know, back in those days, special effects obviously weren't of the caliber they are now, you know.
Oh, they didn't have the computers at that time either, like they've got now, where they can make so much of this stuff up.
Oh, I know, I know. And it was, you know, but even then, when they were when they didn't have anything computer generated and the effects were much more simple as opposed to what we see in the movie theaters and everything today, even then, a lot of preparation went into that, a lot
Absolutely.
Of time and attention, you know.
Mm-hmm. Very, very much so. But with Gilligan's Island, the sets that they worked with and the various things that they had to go through. Now, I really found it interesting to read about Tina Louise, because your husband was not especially fond of Tina Louise. And
no,
Tina
he
Louise
wasn't.
Was this glamour star. She was had the mole in the right place on her face. She had a gorgeous figure.
Oh,
and
yes.
I always got a charge about her wearing evening gowns on this island. I said, "Oh yes, this is real. Yes, this is really real life." Okay, so it was it, but she just had beautiful clothes that she would wear, and she played this ditzy. In my mind, it was this ditzy person that wanted to be the movie star, and it's just really a hoot at how she had an attitude about everything.
You know,
everything.
Tina. I mean, when you think about it, you know, when they filmed the three Gilligan movies, they had two different actresses play Ginger because Tina didn't want to be a part of the movies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as good as the other girls were, and I liked them very much, and I actually knew them. I wasn't around during the series itself, but I was around for the movies. And as good as those girls were, nobody could play Ginger the way Tina did it. Nobody could.
I agree.
I mean, nobody. And she did kind of a Marilyn Monroe takeoff, you know, the whole lip thing when she'd talk, you know, and all that. And she was sexy and wonderful, and nobody could have done the part like she did it. However, she was not, and any of them would tell you this, it wasn't just Bob, she was not the easiest woman to work with. She was,
mm-hmm.
you know, held up production a lot and was, you know, she wanted to be the old Hollywood thing, if you can only film me from this side, you know, and she had all of that going, you know, and the rest of them just went there and hit their marks and said their lines and did their job and were ready on time and never held up production unless there was some kind of gag maybe where, you know, Bob had to go into the lagoon and then, of course, you had to go change clothes and all of that when you're all wet. But, you know, she was really a bit difficult for all of them in that way. Now, I
she
didn't
was like
know
an
her,
old-fashioned
you know,
diva.
She
the
was.
Old-fashioned
I mean, she really, really
image
was.
Image of the diva, yeah.
She was, and she didn't, you know, there was a part of her that she went there actually, and Bob does tell this story in the book, she went there actually thinking that she was the star of the TV series. She'd been doing Once Upon a Mattress, I think it was, on Broadway, and they, you know, took her off the Broadway show and took her to L.A. for this series, and she went to do the series thinking it was, you know, her starring vehicle, and Sherwood Schwartz, the creator-producer, said to her, you know, it's not called Ginger's Island. It's called Gilligan's Island, you know. And and so I think there was a, you know, probably a little bit of a problem for her right then. And when they, you know, when 15 years later, when they did the rescue from Gilligan's Island, she had absolutely no interest in doing the movie and turned it down. Everybody else did it. She turned it down. And Bob used to laugh when it happened. She got more press for turning down the role and not doing it than all the rest of them did for having, you know, having said yes to doing the movie. And they got plenty of press, the ones who said yes, so you can only imagine, you know, how much she got for not doing it. But, yeah, it kind of, You know, she went on to do other things. She did Dallas. She was in the first season of Dallas. I don't know if you remember that. Do you?
No, I don't.
She played JR's secretary. And let me see. She did a lot of other things after that, but nothing quite ever clicked for her the way Gilligan's Island did and the character of Ginger. So somewhere along the line, somewhere down the road, she learned to, like they all did, to embrace the fact that that had been, you know, that that was part of her, that was part of her legacy in the TV world.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and it's still an ongoing legacy.
It is.
It's still running, I believe.
Oh, I don't think it's ever going to go away. I just don't see that happening. I think it's been on the air for 46 years now, actually.
Amazing, amazing. Now, Dawn Wells was Mary Ann, and she is a doll. Now, she wasn't the first one that played Mary Ann. There was another actress. But Dawn Wells, I just chuckled when I saw this exquisite photograph of her surrounded by a fur. She's got these great big dark eyes, this gorgeous dark hair. She's just as cute as she can be. And someone, a fan of hers, said that she was the only thing that got him through puberty. I mean, what woman doesn't want to have someone say, "You got me through puberty"?
That's for sure. You know, and she is as beautiful, truly, inside as she is out. Dawn is one of my... still one of my closest friends, and certainly was one of Bob's best friends, she and Russell. And she's just a lovely woman, you know, busy all the time, constantly has her fingers in a lot of pies, you know, working for charities and still doing, you know, acting gigs when she gets them and finds something she wants to do, travels the world. She's a really interesting woman. I'm proud to count her among my friends, believe me.
Well, she's just a doll. So she, that comes across in her portrayal of the character. I mean, she really was the right one for that.
She, that was her first acting job.
Really?
Simon was. Yeah, I probably shouldn't say the year, she might get me. She was Miss Nevada at one time, and I think she was. She was Miss Nevada. I don't guess she would care. You can Google it and find out, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think it was 1958, if I'm not mistaken. She was Miss Nevada, and that sort of led her into acting. And she loved, you know, she loved it. And like you said, there's nobody that could have played Mary Ann the way she did it. Whole cast, though. It's like you said, you know, the writing was so well done that, you know, you can take any line out of that script and read it and know which character said it or was supposed to say it, because it's not interchangeable with those seven characters, you know?
Right. Now, he had a saying after Gilligan's Island finished its showtime for a while. It's still playing to this day. But I really had to chuckle with one statement that he said, and I thought, you've got to tell me exactly what this meant. And I'm quoting. This is Bob Denver saying, "You can't polish a turd." I said, we got to get educated on this one.
Was he referring to anything in particular with that line?
I think so. And I think he was referring to script writers.
Yeah, that, you know, and I can imagine that he might have been referring to that when he was working on stage, and that's when I met him. And you know, the truth of the matter is that you can't polish a turd, you know?
Mm-hmm.
If you get something that's not well written, I don't care how good of an actor you are, you're not going to be able to make much of it, you know? I mean, having good words in front of you is the best. I remember one time we did a play called, and I've never heard of it since, thank heavens, but it was called The Button, and it was just the worst. It was just so badly written. He might have been talking about that. It was just a really badly written show, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And you can't, you know, if it's not there on the page, on the paper in front of you, as an actor, you really can't do very much unless they allow you the freedom to kind of rewrite it yourself, do it the way you want to do it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they don't normally allow you that freedom. So, yeah, that's very Bob. You can't polish a turd.
Yes, that's him. I mean, it's just, these are just little highlights that when I was reading through the book, it really stuck with me. Now, he did work with one of my favorite comedians, and that's Phyllis Diller. And I know she's not hasn't been public for to the degree she was for so many years. But that woman, I'm telling you, I just loved her because I loved how she described her house cleaning. She'd go out and hire a bulldozer and just push everything out the back door.
I like the way that woman thinks.
I just said, that is a woman after my own heart. But when I read the story in here about him working with her, and they were, it was, have you heard the one around about the traveling sales lady? That was the name of the program. He said he just loved the role interaction with her, and that in this particular show that he did, he played an inventor who lived on a farm, and one of the during one of the scenes, they actually had live cows during the show. One of the cows pooped. And Phyllis looked down and said, I'll never eat spinach souffle again. I mean, this is something. This woman could drop words, and you'd just be really, you'd be gasping for air. I mean, it's just like, how does someone think like that? But she,
I know.
Like,
he loved her. He loved her bodiness. I know that. And, of course, I didn't know him at that time. But, you know, the stories later, he loved her bodiness. I think, as a matter of fact, I know she was the one that, he said they gave her a really early morning call one morning to be on the set, and she turned to, you know, the whoever did it, the assistant director or something, and said, look, I don't even throw up before noon. You know,
she
didn't want to, you know, she didn't want to come in that early, and I'm imagining she probably didn't have to, you know. But
oh, my goodness.
He loved that about her. She was bawdy and a little bit irreverent and a lot of fun, you know, fun to work with and you know, great. Obviously, to do a comedy with.
Now, your husband passed away. What happened? What happened with Bob Denver? I wasn't aware. I thought he was still alive, and then I was told, no, he passed away about 5 years ago. What happened?
He did.
Bob?
You know, he passed away during, you know, a lot of people missed it, and this is kind of the way he would have wanted it. I'm pretty sure he orchestrated it somehow. He passed away during Katrina, so there was so much, you know, that they did cover his death, and there, you know, there was press about it, but it was just overshadowed completely by what was going on in New Orleans. He passed away in 2005. He was originally diagnosed with throat cancer.
Oh my!
And when we went to, we had to leave. I live still in West Virginia, but we had to leave West Virginia and go to Winston-Salem. So when we got there to have that surgery, you know, he had to have a complete laryngectomy, which means that we knew going in that he would never talk again. You know, I'd never hear his voice again. That's a very sad, sad thing. It's hard to, unless somebody's been through it, I guess you can kind of imagine. I thought that was the worst thing that could possibly happen, having no idea that he would ultimately pass away from this. But we went for the throat surgery, and they discovered right just prior to the surgery that he had a heart problem that he might have suspected it, but I was totally unaware of it. Had really bad heart problems. So the bottom line was that once he was diagnosed with throat cancer and then the heart problem, there were just no good moments after that. He was just a very, very sick man, and he lived for, fought a really hard battle that as well as I knew him, we'd been married 28 years at this point, and as well as I knew him and as courageous as I knew he was, I had no idea that kind of courage was inside of him, and I think he probably didn't know there was that kind of courage inside of me as we fought this battle together to try to get him well and bring him home. And it didn't work out that way, you know. So, I don't know. It's a hard thing to go through, you know.
Yes, it is. But he's left a wonderful legacy.
You know, and not only the television legacy, which, of course, is what everybody knows about. He's left me a legacy of, you know, we weren't rich. Everybody thinks because you're on Gilligan's Island that, you know, you have mountains of money in the bank. You know, the castaways were never paid a penny for Gilligan's Island. So there were never any residuals or anything. So even though I wasn't left the rich widow that people think I was, he left me such a legacy of love, truly, with his fans. And that may sound corny, but it really is true. I mean, people love him. They love the show. That spills over onto me because I'm the keeper of the flame. That's how I think of myself. And and it's, you know, it's a beautiful thing that initially I didn't see because I was so deep in grief I couldn't really see anything. And it was probably 2 years after he died that I started, you know, doing interviews and started realizing, you know, the love that was out there for him and the show and how people, you know, how he really got people in. You know, I was going to say this earlier during, once the internet came to be and there was email and websites and people could get to you much more easily, we started getting, you know, a lot of emails from fans who would talk about the fact that they had a really difficult childhood. Maybe they were molested or their parents were drinkers or, you know, they were abused in some way. And they would write Bob to tell him, now these are adults obviously at this point, but they would write to tell him that the half hour escape with Gilligan's Island was the sanest half hour of their childhood every day. Mm-hmm. Now, he was so, you know, when he was making that show, and I'm sure it's true of all the rest of them, nobody thought of that. You know, you think of doing a good job on the show and making it something that people want to see, but you don't think at that time that you're going to have, you know, young people whose lives are being saved in some way by escaping mm-hmm. to the island for half an hour every day, right. You know. And that was very, very moving to him. It was something that meant the world to him. And, you know, that's the kind of legacy I was left, which is a wonderful, wonderful thing. And he was, you know, he's left me that legacy. He's also left the Denver Foundation. Bob and I had a severely autistic son, and we started the Denver Foundation in honor of our son, Colin, and we help people. I'm running the foundation now, and we help families with individuals who have special needs, just like we had when our mm-hmm. son was growing up. And so, you know, his personal legacies to me are the real, I mean, the television legacy is wonderful, don't get me wrong, but the personal legacy obviously impacts me in a very personal way. You know?
I can understand that, Dreema. I know we're out of time, hon, and it's been just a delight having you on the air. What is the website that people can go to find out more about this wonderful book, Gilligan, Maynard, and Me, by Bob Denver? What website?
It would be bobdenver.com.
Bob Denver.
So you'll know, I have written a book. We're shopping it right now, but I've written a book about the personal Bob Denver, about my 28 years with him, and it goes into all of this in much more detail. And
wonderful.
And it will be, I call it Gilligan's Dreams, because he always called me Dreams, and rather than Dreema. And hopefully that book will be out in 2011.
Oh, that's fabulous. You'll have to send me a copy. Well, we're going on break. This is Donna Sebo, my wonderful guest today, the wife of Bob Denver, Dreema Denver, called Dream by Bob. That was his favorite name for her. The book, again, is Gilligan, Maynard, and Me. We're taking a break. Go to the website, bobdenver.com. We'll be back in just a moment.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Enter the magical world of God's kiss.
He sees a large open area of valley ground covered with a thick green grass.
In the open space are many other children and animals. All kinds of animals. And all of the animals are talking. He can understand every word they are saying.
God's Kiss is a beautifully illustrated children's book about a young boy's journey into a valley with children and animals from all over the world. They are gathering together to experience the wonder of love and beauty that will affect their lives forever. A talking book audio narrated by the author Donna Sebo accompanies this wonderful storybook, creating a special magic all of its own. This book package makes a wonderful gift for those special children in your life, ages 3 to 10. God's Kiss book and talking book audio are only $19.95 plus shipping and handling. And the author Donna Sebo will autograph and personalize your book if you request it. Call 800-872-8852. You can also order through Donna Sebo's website, www.delphiinternational.com.
And telephone lines are now open. If you would like to call in and chat with me, I'd be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. Give me a call at 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. I was having a business meeting this morning, and in the course of conversation with the individuals, it came up the old perspective, and I say old because it is timeless, really, that you never have a second chance to make a first impression. And many people, as they're growing up, they'll be lectured, you've got to look this way, you want to make sure that the first time somebody sees you, they have a good image of you. And of course, whenever we're out trying to get a job or we're going to build a professional image, it's something we always keep in mind. But it takes time sometimes to be able to pull that part of ourselves together to really find out what represents us. And I was discussing this with someone this morning, and I said, if you will look at the people around you that you really, really like and respect, I don't care whether it is the author of a book, it could be a public personality. You don't want to copy someone else per se, but if you can look at the qualities in a person that you honestly respect and appreciate and go, wow, I really like how they do certain things, realize that you can incorporate those particular patternings in yourself if that is really what you want to do. And it's been interesting to me to observe how many times people do not realize that. And there is, I think, a need for us as individuals to consistently be willing to invest in ourselves for what is going to serve our purposes and how do we want other people to perceive us. You know, it's one thing if you're a wrestler on worldwide wrestling shows, you've got that particular persona, but that may not be you because you're acting out a certain role. But who you are as an individual really is what's going to be your legacy when you leave this earth. And you need to ask yourself, how would you like to be remembered? And the reason I bring this up is because Dreema talked about the legacy that her husband left her. And even though it wasn't a financial legacy, he left a legacy of joy and love and follow through and persistence and so many things that he was able to give to others through his own expression in his different modalities of show business. But as a man and as a father, as a husband, he also had other things that he was able to share. And I think that that is important for us to remember. So frequently we'll get engrossed and occupied with the image of someone else, maybe up on the television screen or in the movies, and you're up and you're going, wow, I wish I could be them. Remember, you as an individual have been endowed with your own talents, and whatever those talents might be, you may not value them, but they may be very valuable to someone else. So if you will focus on your strengths, focus on your capacities that you just dearly enjoy doing, or as Joseph Campbell would say, follow your bliss. Now, maybe you don't know what that is, but if you are honest with yourself and true to yourself, you are going to leave a legacy that's going to mean so much to so many people because you are truly being who you are as an individual. And that takes a little bit of time to develop. You can't add water, mix, and pour it out of a can. It just doesn't work. It takes a willingness to invest in yourself, a willingness to say, I'm curious about me. And don't ever let anybody tell you you're being narcissistic, because that's not being narcissistic. Not when you want to develop yourself to the finest and best levels you possibly can. It's an ongoing job. You never stop doing it. And it's something that once you have a chance to really polish yourself up well, you're going to find there's always areas that you can streamline. We're never good at everything, but by golly, we sure can make a difference in a few areas that are closest to our hearts. So it takes time to learn how to be who you really are, and it's something that's worth investing in. On my mind, many times, it's worth more than trying to build a huge bank account, because who you are, you carry with yourself 24 hours a day. And if you really like who you are, by golly, you're going to find a lot of other people like you as well. Donna Siebel here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. All I need from you is your first name or your initial, and then let me tell you what I perceive. And after that, when I finish, you can ask me a question about anything that crosses your mind. We are into the holiday season, and there are just so many wonderful stories that people are sharing. And I wanted to share this one about a Christmas angel, because I thought sharing stories like this really feels right. I like it anyway. But for the holiday season, I think it just makes it even a little bit richer. There is an individual by the name of Delwyn Collins. And he was growing up in Fort Worth, Texas, and he was handicapped. He had a learning disability and was sent to a special school environment so his education could go on. Now, his teachers did not know very much about Collins. They did not know that he was a caring expert. Now, he's 52 years old, and he's a cafeteria worker at Tampa General Hospital. And do you know, with his disabilities, he has been considered an angel. I'm using that word, that's an honest word, to hundreds of foster children in Hillsborough County, Florida. The children, just like he was when he was little, they have special needs, and they're often moved from home to home because these are children that are not wanted by a lot of people. He loves them all. And it really touches his heart. And Christmas this year will mark the 21st year he set up a Foster Angels Giving Tree. And it's decorated with paper angels bearing the first names, ages, and gender of foster children and the gifts that each child would like to receive. Now, Collins doesn't make very much money, but every week he sets aside a portion of his paycheck to buy gifts to put under the tree. And this is what he said, I just want to show these children that there is somebody out there in the community who loves them. Now, he just has done this. He didn't ask permission. He didn't ask for approval. He just did it. Because of his sincerity and his follow-through and doing this, it has inspired doctors, nurses, and administrators that work at the hospital he works at to make this giving tree a priority. The hospital employees and visitors will take an angel off the tree and buy the present that the child has requested. Now, of course, as Christmas gets closer and closer, bicycles, dolls, clothes, and video games begin to build a pile. In fact, all of the items are brought into the cafeteria at the hospital, and pretty soon you don't have very much space to move around in. Recently, in the past few years, the program has begun to receive presents from donors throughout the country. There are more than 1,000 children in foster care in and around Tampa that received gifts in 2009. Colin says, "My job is to help and give to others. God doesn't really care if we're rich or poor." Wonderful story. A living angel. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. Hey, I promised you that cranberry recipe, and I ran out of time, so I'm going to give it to you again this afternoon. This is a wonderful cranberry salad that is so refreshing. A little bit of sweetness to it, but easy to make, and I'll share it with you. I got started on it yesterday, so I'm going to repeat it, and we'll do it before the end of the show today, because, again, I ran out of time. We'll be right back. Don't go away.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature. However, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right. Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay only $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 1-800-872-8852. That's 1-800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Gedrose. Buy it today. 1-800-872-8852.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-815-9756. By the way, if you have a favorite recipe and you'd like to send it to me, like Lawn did not too long ago, pop it off to me in an email. Also, if you have a story about the paranormal, I'd love to have your story so it can be included in an upcoming book that I'm putting together. So if it's an out-of-body experience, dreams, whatever it might be, send me your story. Send it to Donna at DelphiInternational.com. And quickly, before I start in with the recipe, so you can get your pad of paper and pen, I want to let those of you who are listening in the state of Washington, I'm doing an appearance. This is going to be at the King's Bookstore on December the 11th, and this is for the Dickens Festival that we've got going on. You can check out all the information online. Just go to the Dickens Festival, Tacoma, Washington, and it'll pop up right there for you. But I'll be at the King Bookstore from 11 until 4, and I'm going to be there doing readings for people, mini consultations, and part of the proceeds will be donated to the the group that puts this all on, and then they have special charities that they represent every year. So it's a wonderful event. It's for the family, and maybe we'll get even a little bit of snow. Who knows? Last year we did, and it really made for a magical day. Cold, but really magical. Gets you in the mood for the holiday season. It's very, very nice. And of course, all of us are participating. We're wearing costumes, and it's really a lot of fun when you do that. Okay, I wanted to also share with you something. You know, every time I come across these little stories, I just think they're so much fun because you realize that many times people don't think. And this is about a Marine. It said, days after we invaded Marja, Afghanistan, one of his Marine fellows found out that his wife hadn't paid the cell phone bill. So he called the company from Afghanistan and asked how he could take care of it. Well, the billing agent said to him, you can go to Western Union and place a money order. And the officer, now he's in Afghanistan, he said, ma'am, I'm in Marja, Afghanistan. We do not have a Western Union handy here. And she said, oh, no problem. You can also go to Walmart. You wonder where people's brains are. Oh, well, as the world turns. Okay, here we go. Here's the layered cranberry mold. Now, this is a wonderful recipe. And oh, it looks so pretty on the table. And you can fix this. And you just need to remember that if you have your gelatin mixture, you can assemble this if you wanted to fix it the day before and whip up certain of the final ingredients that day that you're serving. It will make it a lot easier for you because if you're like me and you've got a house full of people, you really don't want to be having to do everything at the last minute. So let me give this to you. This is a layered cranberry mold, and it has a decadent orange-scented cream that goes with it. Oh, it's wonderful. So you're going to need one apple, one Gala apple. And if you have a food processor, put it in the food processor so it's sliced just wafer, wafer thin. And you want the slices halved crosswise. You need three packages of cranberry-flavored gelatin mix. And those are the three-ounce packages. And you're going to need 2 cups of boiling water and 1 cup of ice-cold water. You're going to need 1 cup of red wine or pomegranate juice. You need 1 can, a 14-ounce can, of whole berry cranberry sauce. And then 1 cup of red seedless grapes, cut them in half, an envelope of unflavored gelatin, 1 pound of cream cheese at room temperature. You need 1 cup of fat-free, plain Greek yogurt. And there's a difference between the Greek yogurt and your standard store yogurt. If you can't find the Greek yogurt, then you just use the regular. 1/2 cup of sugar. 3/4 of a teaspoon of grated orange zest, and you might want to have a little bit of apple available, so if you wanted to use them and some extra grapes for garnish or some mint leaves, whatever you want to do, it's up to you. Now, what you're going to need is a 10-cup mold. A Bundt pan is perfect for this, and you want to arrange 1/3 of the apple slices in a row around the bottom of the mold, and then in a large bowl, you want to whisk your gelatin mix and the boiling water. You want to mix it until it's dissolved. Make sure it is totally dissolved. You don't want any lumps in it. And then once everything's dissolved with the gelatin, you want to whisk in the cold water. And that's also when you add your red wine, if you want, or the juice. It's your preference, whichever you prefer, the pomegranate juice. And then also you're going to stir in, after you've mixed that, you're going to stir in the cranberry sauce. Then you want to take 1.5 cups of that cranberry mixture, put it in a separate bowl, take 1/2 cup of the grapes, mix in your 1/2 cup of sliced grapes, you put that over a bowl of ice and water, and you stir until it begins to thicken. And that's going to take about 10 or 15 minutes. Then you want to spoon that into your mold, smooth the top of the gelatin with your back of your spoon, and then stick it in the refrigerator. You're going to need to refrigerate it for about 20 minutes. Then what you're going to do while that's happening in a small microwavable safe bowl, you want to take your unflavored gelatin and put it on top, sprinkle it over the top of 2 tablespoons of water. And you just leave it alone. You let it stand because the gelatin is going to become very, very soft. It takes about 5 to 10 minutes. You can microwave it on high in 15-second intervals until it is totally dissolved. You put that to the side. Now, on a medium-high speed, you beat your cream cheese, your yogurt, and your sugar until they're creamy smooth. You take 3/4 of a cup of that mixture over to the bowl, a bowl, cover that, and refrigerate it. The rest that's left over, you want to take your 3/4 of a teaspoon of your grated orange zest and mix that in. Then you want to take your unflavored gelatin mixture that has been standing on the side, and you pour that in, and you want to beat everything on low. If you have a hand beater, that's great. You just use that and beat it up until it's nice and thick. Then, if you find that it's not thickening, you put it over on, or put it on top of some ice at the bowl. If it's not thickening like it should, put some ice in a bowl, put this bowl that has a gelatin mixture in it, and then continue to beat, because the icy temperatures will cause it to thicken. That's going to take 10 minutes. So then you'll spread that over the cranberry layer in the mold, refrigerate it for 20 minutes until it's almost firm. Then the remaining cranberry mixture with the remaining apple slices and grapes, you mix those all together, and you want to put that on top of the ice. So just have a good bowl of ice, because that helps the gelatin process to thicken. And you just stir everything until the gelatin is thickening there, and it might take you a few minutes. And then you spoon that into the mold, smooth top, refrigerated overnight. Then when you're ready to serve, all you need to do is to dip your mold into warm water just for maybe 10 seconds, and then put it over your platter, and you shake to remove the mold, and you can fill the center of your mold with your slices of your apple slices and grapes, and it's just beautiful, absolutely wonderful. We are out of time again. Just made it this time. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. This is Donna Sebo. Have a magnificent day. Tomorrow we'll be back talking about the Christmas gift. Join us. You'll want to know more about it. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.